Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, did your brain make you do it? Or maybe it was your genetics. And first, what's behind the rise in suicides? Joining us now is Mark Kaplan. He's professor of social welfare at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. His publications include The Social Nature of Male Suicide, A New Analytic Model, Suicide Among Male Veterans, A Prospective Population-Based Study, and Physical Illness, Functional Limitations, and Suicide Risk. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much for being with us, Mark Kaplan. It's great to have you with us. We wanted to do this segment partly because there has been some evidence, some reports that the suicide rates are going up in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to start to understand what are the factors that explain the rise in suicide rates and what this really means for a society. So why don't we start with what explains the rise, for example, in the CDC report that says these deaths have risen since 2005, something like more than half don't know they have mental health disorders.
The data they reported were not entirely new. I mean, we knew the rates were on the rise. What surprised a lot of people were the additional information that was also reported at the time. Not only did they report trends based on a particular database that they have, but they also reported new findings, or relatively new findings, from something called the National Violent Death Reporting System, which was quite interesting and which got far less attention than the rate on the rise since 1999. Namely, the National Violent Death Reporting System, which I have been funded to study that data set, showed that, which is quite interesting, that is that there are a number of suicide decedents who do not follow the standard, who do not have the standard psychiatric profile associated with suicidality, that perhaps psychopathology is not present. So there were some additional findings that one needs to look at in order to fully understand, the changing nature of suicide in this country. It is indeed going up, but it's not going up in all groups at the same rate. One needs to disaggregate, so to speak, and look at certain groups that seem to be more vulnerable. That is, people in their middle years, men in their middle years in particular, men in their, 45 to 64, which has been getting quite a bit of attention based on work that the two economists, Case and Deaton, showed a couple of years ago. The rise in, that's the group that's experienced the most dramatic rise in suicide in the United States.
So traditionally, has suicide been more prevalent in one gender than the other, or?
Yes.
So
yes.
Historically, how has it been versus?
Well, there are very few, globally speaking, there are very few countries. In fact, we all know of one country, that is China, where the rate of suicide is higher among women than men. Outside of China, most countries pretty much follow the same patterns. Let's focus on the United States for a moment. And these are the most recent statistics from the CDC, namely 2016. And there were about 45,000 deaths overall in the country. Out of those 45,000, about 35,000 were males, and about just a little bit over 10,000 were females. The rate, the ratio of men to women is about, 3 to 4 to 1, depending on which age, too. That's for every age group. But in older people, that is older than 65, men are 12 times, have a rate of suicide that is 12 times higher than their female counterparts. So there's this variability across the board. Some have said that there's a gender paradox in the sense that women are more likely to attempt, and that is true based on the data, and men are more likely to complete and die by suicide, partly due to the methods that men use. More men who die by suicide attempt suicide with a die of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Women are more likely to use less lethal means, that is, means with a lower case fatality rate. But that's also changing. I have one of my PhD students is looking at changing patterns or trends in gun suicide among women, and those rates are on the rise, and about a third of all deaths, suicide deaths among women, involve guns.
So let's talk about why some of these trends are shifting a little bit. Mm-hmm. I understand there are some economic factors, there are some social factors, as well as psychological ones. Can you mm-hmm. divide these up and help us understand what each of these seems to be?
What perhaps you might best refer to is the psychosocial influences on the suicide rate. And for one, there are demographic factors. There are geographic factors. There are cultural factors. Case in point, I recently was having this conversation about Korea. Korea today, unlike the past, has the highest, one of the highest suicide rates, according to the OECD. Some have tried to look at that problem as purely psychological. But I think that misses the point. There are major cultural changes, religious changes, from religions of the past to the religions of the present, towards a more Christian, towards Christianity. So there are a lot of changes occurring at the national level in Korea that might be contributing to the shifts in the suicide rate. In the United States, I was funded by the National Institute of Health, NIH, to study specifically the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, to study the effects of the Great Recession of 10 years ago. And I think there's some interesting findings there that are relevant in terms of the social determinants of suicide. Namely, at the time of the recession, that is end of 2007, December officially starting December 2007, and lasting or ending in June of 2009, we studied using a natural experiment design. In other words, we looked at data before the recession, during the recession, and after the recession. And what we found was the following. Men, the rate of suicide did go up. The rate of alcohol associated, that is, men who died by suicide had alcohol on board, had consumed alcohol, and in many cases were intoxicated. That also went up, which might be a marker of impulsivity. And also what's interesting, and perhaps the most surprising finding for us, and we published these a couple years ago, was the fact that there was a lag effect, a delayed effect for women. So women who were subjected to the Great Recession had a rise in their suicide rate and a rise in their alcohol-linked suicide rate a few years after the men. So there was a delayed effect in the delayed adverse effects of the Great Recession on women.
So what does this tell us in terms of economics? I mean, I'm assuming that while we've got this trend shifting when we have a Great Recession, so there's economic pressure on people, obviously not everybody commits suicide. And so there must be a combination of more than one factor, right? So mm-hmm. we've got the Absolutely. Economic factors coming in, and some people are more susceptible than others.
Absolutely.
What is that?
Yes. That's always an important question. Why, you know, we often focus on those who die and focus on, if you will, the negatives. But what about the positives? What about those who were resilient, who were capable, had the capacity to weather, you know, it could be host resistance, what epidemiologists called host resistance, could be a combination of biological factors, genetic constitution, psychological constitution, social supports. They had protections. They had folks to lean on. But there are many individuals who did not weather the adversities of the economic recession. That is, people and when you look, when you dig a little bit deeper and you drill down a little bit, what you see during the Great Recession was that those who were had fewer years of education had a much higher rate. Those in a lower socioeconomic position to start with were more likely to have a much higher unemployment rate. You know, the unemployment rate varied according to one's education level. Education, to some extent, is destiny as a socioeconomic factor. But in terms of the Great Recession, those with a graduate degree, at least 4 years of college plus maybe a few years of graduate school, had a unemployment rate that was 4%, if not under that. Those with just a high school or less had nearly 12%, even higher rates in some cases. And there was some geographic variability, too. So to add to this mix of psychological vulnerability, gender, genetic, also geographic, they're really critical differences, at least in the United States, according to where you live. If you live on the West Coast, the suicide rates are lower. On the East Coast, northeast part of the country, they're lower. In the middle, they're higher. Between the Mississippi and the mountain region, and that's the area with the highest suicide rate. And then on top of all this, and I did allude to this early on, the role of guns in all this, because in the case of men, over 60% of men who die by suicide do so with a gun. With women, it's about a third.
So it does raise a lot of questions. And one of those questions related to guns is whether that rate of dying by guns, if suicide should be considered on par with homicide. As an expert on suicide, what would you say on this?
That's an important question, because the debate surrounding, and I'm interested in firearm violence as well. I teach a course at UCLA on firearm violence, and I'm very interested in firearm violence, not only as it pertains to suicide, but in general. Two-thirds of all, I'll give you the figures, about 34% of gun deaths in this country are homicides, about 62% are suicides. So the lion's share of gun deaths in this country are suicides, but the debate about gun control has been confined in many ways to homicides and maybe accidental deaths. There's been far less attention. It's almost as if it's a hidden epidemic, if you will, of gun suicides. I don't quite understand why. I think it has some cultural explanations. I think there's certain, you know, it might have something to do with the stigma of mental illness, as well as, you know, people who might have a mental health issue who are perhaps suicidal and have access to guns. That's a debate that we haven't had in this country. So I am always concerned that the discussion, both at in the press and the media, as well as at the policymaking level, have focused away from suicides involving guns. And let me just give you an example. According to the data on which states have the most restrictive gun laws, when you look at California, California gets an A-plus from the Brady Giffords organizations on in terms of restrictiveness, gun restrictiveness. Compared to the rest of the country, California, when you look at the rest of the country and you look at certain age groups, you know, nearly 50-60% of the suicides involve guns. In California, it's 30% or under. So restrictive gun laws do matter in terms of reducing the likelihood of gun use among suicidal individuals.
And then the other factor that you have pointed to in your work is about poverty and the role of poverty.
Exactly.
So
right.
Let's talk about poverty and why it's a role and that trajectory. It doesn't, of course, explain when wealthy people commit suicide, but it sounds like what you're saying is that more poor people commit suicide than wealthy people.
Here's an interesting point about that, is that there's just so much that we don't know about suicide, and we're lumping a lot of heterogeneous factors. Suicides, the types of, you know, I, for one, have always said that, you know, when we look at suicide mortality or suicide morbidity, that we need to separate genders. I mean, the phenomenon of suicide among women is quite different from the phenomenon of suicide among men. Men are more likely to die. Women are more likely to survive after an attempt. And the question of the socioeconomic determinants, I think that's a different type of suicide than the type of suicide that we often think of. You know, the recent deaths of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain kind of highlighted, you know, the white, you know, that perhaps well-educated white individuals are most vulnerable. Well, that is true to some extent, but there are a lot of hidden suicides. There's suicidal behavior that doesn't necessarily lead to death, but is clearly a form of self-harm that's associated with one's socioeconomic position, one's disadvantage. Poverty emerged as a factor in one of the last studies we did under this grant was to try to disentangle the different determinants during the Great Recession. We looked at unemployment. We looked at home foreclosures, which was one of the markers, right, of the Great Recession. You know, we take a look at any pictures, you'll see signs everywhere around the country for foreclosed homes. And then we also looked at the rate of poverty. And what really stood out, which was a surprising finding, what above everything else, it was poverty that seemed to be driving up the suicide rate and the alcohol-linked suicide rate.
Are there certain common factors that we can point to psychologically that merge with these social factors, like certain emotions. And I ask this partly because of things like anxiety and shame. And I guess it was a week ago, we did a program on healing trauma in people who have experienced trauma. And we talked about emotions like shame and how hard it is to heal somebody who has persistent shame. Are these emotions something that are important common ground that go with the social factors?
They do, but they should not be stripped away from their social context. And that is, there are social determinants of depression. When one loses a job, one becomes demoralized. One becomes, you know, begins to feel those negative emotions that may contribute to a trajectory leading up to a suicide attempt. So what concerns me is that we tend to individualize, if you will, or over-psychologize the phenomenon of suicide. You know, many people have said, folks in the profession of, you know, studying suicide, have said that, you know, suicide should not be, is not the exclusive domain of the psychological sciences. That we need to look at, if there's one thing we learned from Durkheim, writing in the late 1800s, who is still relevant today, major shifts, societal shifts, the way society is organized, all contribute to a rise in suicide. And that to do anything less than examine those social forces, I think we do ourselves an injustice by failing to look at the broader, the more distal determinants of suicidal behavior.
So one of the factors, so I'm a political scientist, and so I'm always curious about the politics of all of this. Mm-hmm. And one of the politics I would imagine is the politics of healthcare.
Yeah.
And where that might come into play. So, for example, we do get messages societally about how we should be able to heal ourselves, right? We've got plenty of self-help books and gurus and life coaches. And
but it's often heal thyself.
Yes, it's often heal thyself. And it happens to be expensive.
Of course, but the issue of personal responsibility is creeping back. As you know, we are attaching all sorts of conditions to receiving welfare, so to speak, whether it is health care, whether it is food stamps, whether it is you name it. We are putting the onus, that's the result of a conservative wave. That is the imposition of responsibility on the individual, as opposed to assuming a more socially just approach, which is an emphasis on collective responsibility. We're not quite there yet. Let me give you an example of during the time we were studying the Great Recession, I had some interactions with colleagues in Sweden. I spent my last Fulbright in Sweden, and I established some close relationships, and I went back to them after we started our project, and I said, did you guys experience the rise in suicide that we did? And there was a pause there, and he said, "No, not at all. We didn't. Nothing really changed that much. The reason for that is that they stepped in, and that safety net was strengthened. In other words, workmen's compensation, unemployment compensation, everything that we've wrapped around people at times, all those services were there. And the state stepped in, and there was a collective response to it, and they softened the blow of the global financial crisis in Sweden. We basically lowered the safety net and allowed people to fall. Many of them fell and wound up taking their own lives."
So I imagine a big part of this is also that sort of social stigma that you sort of alluded to in this whole conversation sort of falling down and not having the ability to pick oneself up and also the stigma that gets attached.
Exactly. Well, you're talking about multiple barriers here. One is the stigma. I mean, there's no doubt, you know, we've tried for years to establish parity between mental health and physical health. We're nowhere close to that. I mean, no one will tell you with a straight face that we have achieved parity in terms of treating the two where there's no stigma. As you know, there are many people who walk around who have kept silent about their distress. And there are a lot of people distressed. It's not just depression. There are probably more people who are distressed out there, but are unable, unwilling to discuss their feelings.
Now, do you think that there are a chunk of people in this percentage that have no known mental illness that are actually suffering from a mental illness?
The bottom line is that we don't know. Let me take you back to something early on. You know, we don't even know how many people die by suicide every year, believe it or not. The 45,000 people approximately who died in 2016 is probably an underestimate. I have colleagues of mine in West Virginia, Professor Ian Rocket and Professor Eric Kane at Rochester, who published a piece in one of the JAMA journals a few years ago, and they noted that unlike the official statistic of suicide being the 10th leading cause of death, they argue that if we really took into account, you know, many of these deaths that are due to drug intoxication that look very much like suicides, our rate of suicide would probably be rank 8th, not 10th. So, and years ago, the Institute of Medicine in their 2002 report, Reducing Suicide, a National Imperative, argued that our rates are probably, the true rate is probably 25% higher. And let me tell you something else which we have uncovered, and this is somewhat exploratory analysis, but it is very informative, and that is there are lots of silent suicides. You know, people who do not have the standard markers of standard psychiatric markers of suicidal behavior, that is, don't have a history of depression, don't have a problem with substance abuse, all those things that we often attribute, all those risk factors that we often aim our efforts at. In the analysis we did, there were about 22%, in the database we had, about 22% of the men were basically men without any of these markers, these standard factors that we often say are contributors to suicide.
Now, there's something else that people have questioned, and that is this role of sort of copycat whenever it's in the media. Is that a real phenomenon, or is that just people being afraid?
Well, I was interviewed after one of the deaths by a celebrity. I was interviewed by after each one of them, but one of them, you know, because this came up shortly after that. I think it was Robin Williams, right? There was a lot of concern. There was some research that was published, a study that came out that said there were some deaths attributed to him. There's pretty strong evidence based on the World Health Organization that there is some evidence that a death of a celebrity can trigger some other suicides. There's no doubt about it. But the question is, were these individuals already vulnerable? Did somebody go from no vulnerability at all, zero vulnerability, to becoming vulnerable enough to take their own lives? There are questions that we simply don't know. There's an inability, I think, in the field to truly embrace complexity. And suicide, to me, is one of the most complex public health problems that I ever looked at, and I'm a public health researcher.
Yeah, you must think that in order for somebody to commit suicide, they must be in so much pain that staying alive is not an option.
Oh, absolutely. One of my areas of interest is quality of life, health-related quality of life. And there are people, there are individuals who feel that their condition, they feel worse than dead. That's what they say. So yes, there are people who we might even come across who feel a profound sense they're, you know, are facing some existential crisis and feel a tremendous amount of distress in their lives and don't communicate this. And it's true. It's probably true for men. You know, they're you know, men who don't often like to talk about their emotions. You know, that's probably playing, you know, male psychology is playing some role in why, you know, in explaining why men have a higher rate of death due to suicide.
So I suppose there's a certain amount of compassion that we should probably be really lending to this situation as a society that perhaps we're not giving enough to.
Well, you know, I think if we were a more compassionate society, we would probably devote more of our national resources to the study of suicide. Just case in point, I was looking at what the National Institutes of Health spend on the and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention spend on the on research involving, you know, studying the epidemiology and the prevention of suicide. You know, we spend this was for, you know, this is a couple years back now, about 5 years, 2013, suicide received $37 million, okay? Heart disease, $1.2 billion. HIV/AIDS, $2.9 billion. Prostate cancer, $266 million. And guess what? HIV/AIDS, the death rate between 2002-2013 dropped by 53%. Heart disease, the death rate dropped by 29%. The prostate cancer, the rate dropped by about 14%. Suicide, the rate went up 2003 to 2013 by over 20%.
So do you think that the paucity of funding to understand suicide is coming from our own sort of societal denial?
Well, I think it's a denial. I think there's the historic problem, and this is an ancient problem, of some of the myths, the stereotypes, the stigma of mental illness. I mean, that there's no question about that. But not everybody who takes their life had a diagnosable psychiatric problem. You know, there's a dispute about that. There's a dispute about where that data comes from. If you look at other countries, the role of psychopathology in suicide is a lot less significant of a factor than in the United States. But there's no question, you know, mental health is a big problem. Guns is a big problem, too. You know, the problem of, at least in suicide, most suicides are gun-related. And they're even more gun-related among men. And if we were more serious about the gun debate, we would probably do something about, limiting access to guns among people who are, perhaps suicidal, but not even, you know, there, as I said before, there are people who are not suicidal, who have access to the gun and wind up taking their own lives. They may have faced, and this is one of the things we found in an earlier study, that sometimes all it takes is a major crisis, some existential crisis that drives people to short circuit some of the standard trajectories that people take when they take their lives, and basically go from experiencing a major crisis to ending their lives with a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
So it's probably... The country is probably in a bit of an existential crisis at the moment. States.
I mean, it's almost a state of denial in many ways of the role that guns play in suicide, the magnitude of the problem of suicide, and it's probably even worse than people think. In many age groups, it's the number two or number three leading cause of death. In this country, it's probably the eighth leading cause of death, and yet we devote so few of our national resources, and I think that's a shame, and that's the denial, and that's the lack of collective responsibility for this important, you know, public health crisis.
And so, in terms of where we go from here, if you were going to make one very solid recommendation, would you just say we need to understand this better, so we need to devote more funds to it, or would there be something else?
One obviously approach is to extend funding. For instance, there's a national database called the National Violent Death Reporting System. And the National Violent Death Reporting System, or NVDRS, has been historically underfunded, and it would provide us with some insights. It's a unique database in the industrialized world, and it would provide us with new information on some of the factors associated with suicide deaths. I think we need to spend more money at the national level in terms of prevention at the NIH and CDC and other agencies. That would be helpful. But we also, at a more theoretical conceptual level, I think we need to step back a little bit and widen our lens, or what I would call widening our lens. You know, many of us operate in silos as we study suicide. Most of us do not adopt a truly transdisciplinary approach to suicide. And given the complexity and the more proximal versus distal risk factors involved, I think there's a real need to reconceptualize how we've approached, how we've studied suicide. We need new streams of funding, and we need to have a political will at the national level and at the highest level. I mean, most of our leaders have tried and have been unsuccessful. President Obama tried to expand the NVDRS, tried to do more through the CDC, and, you know, it unfortunately, some of these issues get bogged down because of the gun debate, you know, get caught up in gun politics. And that's a big problem. But, you know, we have had on the books for a long, long time something called the Dickey Amendment, which has basically placed a moratorium on the funding of gun research in this country, as you might know, through the CDC and the NIH. This goes back to the 90s. So we are far behind in understanding the role that guns play in suicide.
Well, Mark Kaplan, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Mark Kaplan. He is professor of social welfare at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. His publications include The Social Nature of Male Suicide, a New Analytic Model, Suicide Among Male Veterans, a Prospective Population-Based Study, and Physical Illness, Functional Limitations, and Suicide Risk. When we come back, evidence that human behavior is not rational, not conscious, and may be completely programmed without our rational thinking. Stay tuned.
Scholar Circle celebrates National History Month.
I carry your heart with me. I carry it in my heart. I am never without it. Anywhere I go, you go, my dear. And whatever is done by only me is your doing, my darling. I fear no fate, for you are my fate, my sweet. I want no world, for beautiful you are my world, my true. And it's you are whatever a moon has always meant, and whatever a sun will always sing is you. Here is the deepest secret nobody knows. Here is the root of the root, and the bud of the bud, and the sky of the sky of a tree called life, which grows higher than soul can hope or mind can hide. And this is the wonder that's keeping the stars apart. I carry your heart. I carry it in my heart.
That was the poet E.E. Cummings reading his work, I Carry Your Heart With Me.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Scientists are finding more and more evidence that human behavior is not rational, not conscious, and may be completely programmed without our rational thinking. That's the subject of two books. The first one is called The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. And we also have another book called Red Genes, Blue Genes, Exposing Political Irrationality. We've got both authors with us. Shankar Vedantam is an award-winning science reporter. He's written The Hidden Brain. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Maria. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. We also have with us Guillermo Jimenez. He's a professor of international trade at the State University of New York, and he's the author of Red Genes, Blue Genes. Welcome, Guillermo.
Great to be here.
So you're both talking about an irrationality, but you're approaching it slightly from different places. So why don't we start with Shankar and your findings? You open, actually, with this story of a rape victim and how she misidentifies a rapist, but she's certain that this was him. She's memorized all these parts of his face and his body so she can report it to the police. And then she made a mistake. The jury made a mistake. He spent 13 years in prison. And you say this was an unconscious thing that happened to her that was partly determined by her mood and emotions and other unconscious things. Explain that.
Well, this is a really tragic story, Maria, involving a woman called Toni Gustas, who was raped in Massachusetts about 2 decades ago. And what distinguished her, I think, is that she was a remarkably conscientious eyewitness. She took great pains during the crime to memorize the features of the man who was committing the crime. But over the course of the next weeks and months, as police showed her many, many images of people whom they thought might be potential suspects, and then eventually the person whom they thought was the suspect who had committed the crime, her memory of the case degraded to some extent. And she was pretty sure the police had the right person, but there was a little bit of a doubt at the back of her mind. And she spent that Christmas with her family at a church that had long been a source of comfort and solace for her. And while sitting in the church, her doubt slipped away, and she told herself that she had gotten the man, that it was the person who had raped her. As it turned out, a DNA test conducted about a decade later showed that this man could not have been the criminal. And it prompted Toni Gustas to go through a very lengthy period of recrimination and wondering how she could have made the error she made. The point that I was trying to make in this chapter and that I make throughout The Hidden Brain is that we regularly think that people's intentions are decisive, that if someone means to be a good eyewitness or a good juror or a good judge or a good politician, that they are a good juror, judge, or politician. It turns out that there is much in our lives that lies outside the boundaries of our conscious awareness. And in this church where Toni Gustas's doubt slipped away, in some ways I make the argument that reassurance and solace were not her friends in this situation. Her doubt that was at the back of her mind was actually her friend, because it was telling her something is not quite right.
What had happened, in particular with this, there were all these emotions that had come into place and that had her really make a misjudgment.
I think that's right. And the ironic thing in this case was that she was someone who had been through a traumatic event, and you can see why it would be most understandable for her to seek a situation where she was comforted and had some solace from the situation. But she was also in a position where she was being asked to make a very difficult judgment. And the point that I was trying to make in this chapter is, without her intending to make a mistake, in fact, with her intending to do things exactly right, and she was a really conscientious, diligent person, and someone whom I respect and regard very, very highly, she yet made this mistake. And the point that I was trying to make is, if this mistake can happen to Toni Gustas, it can happen to any of us.
Now, you have talked about some other really important phenomena that deal with race, with gender, and even when people are conscientiously trying not to have that be an issue, how they are still programmed, in essence.
Indeed. I think much of the book that I've written looks at the question of the unconscious very broadly. It's sort of how we make unconscious bias affects our romantic decisions, our financial decisions, our moral decisions, our political decisions. And one of the domains that I explore at some length is the question of unconscious prejudice. There has been a really explosion of research in the last 20 years looking at unconscious prejudice, how to measure it, what effects it has. And the striking thing again here is that, we pay a lot of attention to hate crimes or people who explicitly say racist things or sexist things. But it turns out that at an unconscious level, prejudice exists in very, very, very large numbers of people, perhaps even among most people. And these effects are subtle. They're not sort of the person who is, burning a cross on someone else's lawn. This is a person who may have an unconscious association in their heads. But when they are asked to make a decision about whether somebody is guilty or innocent of a crime, or whether to hire someone for a job, these unconscious associations play very powerful roles, especially because most people do not believe the unconscious exists. And so we have no way to guard against the manipulation, because we don't even realize that we are being manipulated.
I thought one of the most convincing parts of your book was dealing with gender bias, in the only way they could really measure it was with transgendered people. And so here you had, for example, somebody who transgendered from a woman to a man, and suddenly same person, same qualifications, same education, and the income went up and the interruption stopped.
That's right. So the challenge I was trying to explore in this chapter is that there is abundant research showing that on average, women are not paid the same as men. They face all kinds of challenges compared to men. But when you're asked to make a judgment about any individual person, say Hillary Clinton, it's very difficult to apply the general research on bias to an individual, because in any individual circumstance, there are many other factors. How good a candidate is Hillary Clinton? What are her positions on the issues? What's the competition like? And so on. But then I realized that there was a group of people who, in effect, could become their own control groups, and these were people who were transgendered. And I found remarkably that there was research showing that when men transition to being women, their hourly salaries drop, and often drop quite dramatically. When women transition to being men, their hourly salaries on average rise. But the real effects of sexism are actually much more subtle than just a question of salary. Men who become women experience losses of all kinds of privileges that they didn't know they had. And women who become men experience sort of the relief in some ways of being carried by a current that they didn't even know existed. And that's stronger than them in some ways. So it's a disturbing chapter in many ways, But the transgendered, who themselves, of course, face many challenges because they are transgendered, offer us a very, very powerful and insightful window into the nature of sexism in the United States.
There's one other phenomenon I want to have you talk about, and that is this chapter that opened with the fate of a young woman, Delitha Word, and how she was essentially tortured and beaten to her death among a crowd of people who stood there aghast at what was happening, but nobody took action. You said that if one person would have taken action, perhaps the whole crowd would have moved. Talk about that phenomenon.
Well, I think this phenomenon actually has been widely described for a very long period of time. It's called the bystander effect in psychology, and there have been many cases like this. The Kitty Genovese case in New York some years ago, for example, showing that often when terrible things unfold, we intuitively believe that it's a good thing to have many people around, because if there are many people, then surely there will be some good Samaritans among them. It turns out that the opposite is true, that you're more likely to have people come to your aid and assistance when there are a few people rather than many people. The insight that I've tried to bring to this chapter is to try and show that the bystander effect doesn't just affect our ability to act in the service of other people. It affects our ability to act in the service of ourselves. And I try and show that in disaster settings, when we receive an ambiguous warning of disaster, the same thing happens when we are confronted by somebody else who is in danger. When we're surrounded by large groups of people, in some ways, groups rob us of our autonomy and our ability to act in intentional ways. And there is very compelling research showing that these forces played a very large role in the events that unfolded on the morning of September 11, 2001, in the South Tower of the World Trade Center in particular.
And the South Tower in particular because?
Well, the South Tower was the second tower to be hit that awful morning, and there was a 16-minute window between when the first tower was hit and the second tower was hit. And a substantial part of this chapter talks about a financial trading firm that was spread over the 88th and 89th floor of the South Tower. And after the rubble had cleared, I showed that nearly everyone on one floor had escaped the building and survived, whereas nearly everyone on the other floor stayed behind at their desks and perished. And my point was not so much that one group made the right decision and one group made the wrong decision. We know, of course, the group that left was making the right decision, but we know that in hindsight. The point that I'm trying to make is that in crises, people tend to act together. People are either silent together or they act together. They either intervene together or they're passive together. They either flee together or they stay at their desks together. Groups rob us of our autonomy when crises break out. And this is something that has a great deal of consequence, not just for our ability to act in moral ways, but for our ability to protect ourselves and those we love in times of disaster.
Guillermo Jimenez, you actually bring an extra element into this, which has to do with kind of the genetic part, kind of a biological predisposition towards political outcomes.
One of the arguments that I make in the book is that not all of us, but most of us are born somewhere along with a left-to-right political disposition, and that influences our political orientation throughout our lives in kind of the unconscious and unperceived way that Shankar was talking about. And so the great majority of us do have some political bias that we're guilty of, but we tend to not perceive it because it lies in the unconscious, and we have a lot of techniques of self-deception to prevent that from rising to our consciousness. But we perceive it very well in the other party. And that's one of the funny things about irrationality, is that we can see it in others, but not in ourselves. I think, you know, the insight that I propose is that as liberals, we are not immune to this kind of irrationality. We have our guilty parties as well. And in a very similar way to the way that Republicans or conservatives view politics from a biased perspective, we do as well.
This way that you opened your book, you talked about how you were watching Orrin Hatch, and from every fiber of your being, everything that you saw, heard, the way he wore his hair, the way he wore his tie, the way he spoke, his accent, everything made you recoil. You said, in essence, his DNA really upset your DNA. And you said that this is especially now prevalent on both sides, and that this political irrationality is driven by a number of phenomena. I think partly you're saying there's a genetic base to it, but I think Shankar's piece also here and some of the research you brought in terms of groups and in terms of emotions. And the question I think I'm trying to get to is, how much of it is this media blitz that we're getting on both sides. And we've all read the works of Cass Sunstein. And how much of it is really a distinction between them? Guillermo, why don't you start, and then let's see what Shankar has to say.
Research that I cite that's very interesting, there's a professor named John Hibbing out at the University of Nebraska that's done some just incredible groundbreaking research in the field of the biological bases of our political dispositions. I'll just mention, you know, very briefly, one of his experiments got a group of people that he had categorized previously through questionnaires as very liberal or very conservative. And he exposed them to these startling stimuli, like loud noises, gruesome photographs, and then he measured their involuntary responses. And what he found is the people that were more instinctively fearful, that corresponded with conservative political orientation. In other words, those people were more likely to support defense spending, the Iraq war, capital punishment, patriotism, whereas the people that showed a calmer or less fearful instinctive response were more likely to support pacifism, liberal immigration policies, foreign aid, and so forth. And what that suggests is that there is a biological component, which may be slight or may be slender, but is definitely present and detectable in our political opinions. And what's kind of shocking to us about that is that we don't perceive it ourselves. You know, we think that we come to all of our political opinions through some exercise of logic or reason. And I argue that it's about 50% genetics. But what's even more concerning is that on top of that genetic layer, we also have a cultural layer which also reinforces biases and prejudices. So most of us end up doubly prejudiced or biased in our politics, partially our biological inheritance and partially from our social upbringing.
Shankar, what would you add?
Well, I certainly think Dr. Jimenez is right in terms of the idea that I think there are certain biological predispositions to political orientation. The thing that I find fascinating about our divide is twofold. One, why is it so much more intense today than it was, say, 50 years or 100 years ago? You know, our biology hasn't changed, but if you look at the number of Democrats who are passionately against a Republican president and vice versa, the gap is just extraordinary today compared to where it was 100 years ago. And the other thing that I find really intriguing, and this is really in some ways a puzzle to me, is when you look at many of the issues that divide liberals and conservatives, they don't fall along what you would call logical patterns. So, for example, conservatives are against government intervention in general, and they want sort of a hands-off, laissez-faire policy. But when it comes to abortion or family values issues, they want a very interventionist government policy. They want sort of government to be involved in sort of running people's lives or telling people, here's what's appropriate and here's what's inappropriate. The striking thing here is not, I'm not trying to point out necessarily that one side is being hypocritical, because I think Guillermo is right in terms of saying that both sides are guilty of this. The interesting thing is why it is that people don't see these inconsistencies themselves, that when you're on one side, there's nothing that your side can do that feels wrong, and there's nothing that the other side that can do that feels right. And I've seen some very interesting research from political science that argues that in many ways, the driver behind partisanship is sort of the same driver that's behind our passion for our sports teams. So, you know, I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan, and when I think about it, it's absurd to be a fan of any single football team, because these are players who are interchangeably going between the different teams. They just happen to be wearing one set of colors. But, you know, when I'm watching a game, my team can do no wrong, and every ambiguous call of the referees make, I sort of say, well, you know, they made a mistake and they should have given it to the Eagles. And I think the same thing is happening at the political level as well, that we sort of identify with either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party in the same way we identify with sports teams, and that in some ways causes us to fail to see the inconsistencies of our own positions and fail to see the weaknesses in our own side or any good in the other side.
You know, there was some research done a while back in political psychology that showed that membership of a group, even if it's completely arbitrary,
right,
automatically creates an us and a them and creates competition. Perhaps that's a missing element, and that's the thing that needs to be understood. Guillermo, you actually also talked about this phenomenon. What do you have to say?
I think the example or the symbol of the sporting contest is a great one, and was actually used in a lot of the psychology research. You know, students are assigned to watch a basketball game, and they're randomly assigned to one or the other team. And what we discover is within minutes, they become very biased in favor of that team. And that is quite similar, I think, Shankar is right, to the bias that we exhibit on behalf of our political parties. But I would say to his point, you know, why is it increasing? Why are we perceiving it to be such a problem these days? Well, there are a number of reasons. The first thing I would say is there are some political scientists at Princeton, Nolan McCarty and Keith Poole, who wrote a book called Polarized America, that studied the history of polarization in the Congress, and they found that polarization in Congress increases in times of economic stress. And when we are trying to rewrite our fundamental social contracts, it kind of makes sense that we'll get more polarized. We've got health care reform. It's going to change our country. And so when things like that are on the table, it's kind of natural that you'll have some polarization. But on top of that, you have the phenomena of the modern media and the internet. One thing that Cass Sunstein says, you know, Maria mentioned earlier, is that nowadays, you know, we can get all of our information from biased news sources. And a lot of people do. I mean, there's a lot of people that watch Fox News, and then they read the Wall Street Journal, and they read Ann Coulter's books, and they're not going to get a very fair and balanced view of reality that way. And then finally, on top of that, you add the modern media circus, which makes money from this conflict. And, you know, the great example is our political presidential campaigns, where all of the media giants just run political shows all day long. And how do they get eyeballs to those shows? It's by presenting us figures like Sarah Palin and divisive figures that rile up our emotions and get our eyeballs glued to those TVs. So, you know, we have a number of factors working together which have given us kind of this perfect storm of polarization that we're now in.
I'd actually like to also bring in, since you're talking about media, the issues of fear and loathing, which you say are the most dangerous parts of political irrationality. Guillermo?
Yeah, well, I think we need to fear political irrationality. I think the insight I want to get across in my book is that we have to examine it in ourselves, and we have to be wary of political appeals to fear and to hatred. Now, I think the problem on both sides, our politicians attract our attention by creating fear in us. And liberals, unfortunately, can be as guilty of this as conservatives. You know, conservatives present a frightening picture of liberals, statists who want to, you know, control your very life. And liberals present this counter portrait of, you know, hateful, racist, corporate, warmongering conservatives. And the result is not a happy one for our political environment in general.
You know, that reminds me of something that Shankar wrote about, which was about terrorism and extremism and how there is no real psychological profile that's different between a suicide bomber and somebody else. What does this mean to us, Shankar?
Well, this was a chapter that looked specifically at sort of extreme behavior, and I try to make the argument, Maria, that even though it seems as if that terrorists come from dysfunctional backgrounds or dysfunctional personalities, there has been systematic research conducted among people who attempted to be suicide bombers, their missions failed, and now they're in prisons all over the world. And the research into these people shows that they are hardly more aberrational than the rest of us. In many ways, they may suffer from fewer mental illnesses. They seem to be more idealistic than the rest of us. And nor is it the case that they're particularly more religious than the rest of us. And I find this particularly striking. If you look at the history of suicide terrorism, actually, religion turns out to be neither necessary nor sufficient as an explanatory factor for suicide terrorism. What is common to suicide terrorism in different eras, from the Japanese kamikaze bombers in the closing days of World War II to the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers in the 1980s to, you know, the various suicide terrorist outfits today, is that suicide terrorists typically are formed in an environment where they're essentially cut off from the outside world for a variety of reasons. And in our normal lives, most of us get pulled in different directions. You know, we have ties to our families and to our churches and religions and sports teams and professions. And, you know, this creates stress in our lives. But for the suicide bomber goes into what I call the tunnel. And within the tunnel, the person doesn't face the conflicts of the outside world. All of the reference points within the tunnel are the reference points created by people within the own group. And when you have this, what you have is a dynamic called small group psychology that takes over. And one of the things that small group psychology can accomplish is it can change the norms of what's good and bad behavior. So what seems aberrational to us outside the tunnel can become aspirational to the people within the tunnel. And so when we ask, why do suicide bombers do this aberrational thing, what we're not really taking into account is that we're standing outside the tunnel. We're not seeing how the norms have been systematically turned upside down within the tunnel, that is the suicide bombers' framework.
And that, of course, is very much like Zimbardo has taught us in terms of the what he calls the Lucifer effect. And I think that would bring us also, Guillermo Jimenez, you talk about these entire histories that are completely different from left and from right and what ends up taking us to war. And maybe this is what we're going to end on. Talk about taking us to war and how the left and the right see this in opposites.
Probably the most eminent scientist in this whole field of bias is a man at Princeton, Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in 2002. And he developed the whole modern theory of cognitive bias. Why are we biased? Why do we come to wrong perceptions, wrong conclusions? And he applied these theories to modern conduct of war in an article called Why Hawks Win. And what he observed was that, you know, most of the cognitive biases that we've discovered in the past 40 years tend to favor sort of a militaristic, warlike approach. And that if we examine the conduct of leaders in as we lead up to war, we find a lot of impact of the most common and cognitive biases that humans are subject to. I think probably the classic example is the Iraq War. And the one of the most common biases that plagues human beings is our overconfidence bias. Human beings are tremendously overconfident. And the great example there was Vice President Cheney predicting that, you know, the American soldiers would be welcomed in Iraq as liberators. And, you know, anybody who's read what's going on in Iraq knows that that was never the case. So that's just one example of how our biases expose our leaders to go to war.
Guillermo Jimenez, thank you so much. Shankar Vedantam, thank you so much for being with us. Shankar Vedantam is an award-winning science reporter. He's written The Hidden Brain. Guillermo Jimenez is a professor of international trade at the State University of New York, and he's the author of Red Jeans, Blue Jeans. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
E.E. Cummings. Freedom is a breakfast food.
Freedom is a breakfast
food. Yes, as freedom is a breakfast food, or truth can live with right or wrong, or molehills are from mountains made. Long enough and just so long will being pay the rent of seam, or genius please the talent gang, and water most encourage flame. As hat racks into peach trees grow, or dreams dance best on bald men's hair, and every finger is a toe, and any courage is a fear. And robins wail by children stung, or as the seeing are the blind. And robins never welcome spring, nor flat folk prove their world is round, nor dingsters die at break of dong, and commons rare, and millstones float. Long enough and just so long, tomorrow will not be too late. Worms are the words, but joy is the voice. Down shall go which and up come who. Breasts will be breasts, thighs will be thighs. Deeds cannot dream what dreams can do. Time is a tree, life one leaf, but love is the sky, and I am for you. Long enough and just so long.
Dr. Lawrence Fishburne.